This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Congressman Dan Kildee says this should be a year of action in Congress. In a statement issued Tuesday night after President Obama's State of the Union address, Kildee, a Democrat from Flint, said another election year and a broken political system can't be allowed to paralyze progress. Congressman Kildee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So realistically, what can get done in an election year, given that everyone's vision is kind of pointed towards November, and there really aren't that many session days scheduled, or not as many as you had last year anyway?
Yeah, that's part of the problem, is that with the national conventions taking place quite a bit earlier this year, we'll be in session until about mid-July. And then we have the recess and then the election recess. So we've got really the first half of the year to try to get to any big issues that we might want to take on. I think the president sounded a tone that at least presented an openness to address those issues that are not typically viewed as partisan issues. You know, big questions like dealing with the Affordable Care Act, even budget issues, tax policy, those are often more divisive. But for example, there's universal agreement, almost universal agreement on both sides of the aisle in Washington that we need to address criminal justice reform. Our justice system is broken. It's not achieving the kinds of results that we need to. We have 2 million people in prisons in this country, and it's not making us any safer. And we have this moment where folks on the Republican and Democratic side have indicated a willingness to address that. That's the kind of thing that we ought to be able to take up in an election year that will be less divisive.
Are there any other things which have maybe a little less partisanship attached to them that Republicans and Democrats can find some common ground on and can get done, as you say, realistically in the first half of the year?
Well, I think it would be a big lift, but an example of something we should be doing is going much bigger on infrastructure. We have roads, bridges, rails, ports, water and sewer systems, which, of course, relates to the challenges in Flint in part, that all of that needs massive reinvestment. If we look at our competition across the globe, one of the reasons that China, despite their current problems with their economy, but one of the reasons that they have generally been emerging as an economic power is that they're spending 10 times what we are as a percentage of GDP on infrastructure. Infrastructure is essential to industry. I've never seen a Republican road or a Democratic road. So, you know, to me, that's one of those issues. If we were to do something really big, it's probably the one thing that we could do in a year that is going to be marked by partisanship, because it's simply not that much of a partisan question.
The president called for more or less, as he said, a moonshot for trying to find a cure for cancer. West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton on this side of the state has been pushing the idea of 21st century cures. I know that's out of the House at this point. But right. Is this one of those issues, the idea of more research, more ways of trying to get at big diseases, things which have been searching for cures for a long time, that there could be some bipartisan agreement on?
It should be. And, you know, Fred deserves a lot of credit. I was actually a co-sponsor of 21st Century Cures, and we'd love to get that through the Senate. Where we get into difficulty, and it's certainly not Fred or those who represent that wing of the Republican conference, but where we get into difficulty is research on cures. Medical research requires money. And we have seen a modest increase in the funding for the National Institutes of Health in the budget agreement that we just enacted, but it's the first increase in a long, long time. And my view is that we ought to not be just looking at modest increases. We ought to be doubling and tripling the amount of money that we put into medical research, not just because it could have an incredible effect on human suffering, although that's the principal reason. But I actually believe that if we want to balance our budget and bend the cost curve on healthcare, we will try to unlock the code for diabetes, for Alzheimer's. And even if we just address those two really important and debilitating diseases, we could do amazing things for people, but also significantly reduce the cost of healthcare in this country. So it's a smart thing to do, and we ought to be pursuing it much more aggressively than we had been.
Your guest for the State of the Union address was the sister of Amir Hekmati, the man from Flint who's been held in an Iranian prison now since 2011. You were hoping that you would actually hear the president address that during the speech. Are you disappointed that you didn't hear something about Amir Hekmati during the address?
Yeah, I would have loved to have heard him say the name. I understand, though. I mean, there are 435 members of Congress, 100 senators, and we all have suggestions as to what we'd like to hear from the president. I think it would have been appropriate for him to mention the Americans being held, particularly Amir Hekmati. My bigger aim in the effort that Sara Hekmati and her husband, Dr. Rami Kurdi, who were both at the State of the Union, their reason to be in Washington was to continue to raise this case. And we were able to do that. It would have been great had the president mentioned it, but I'm confident that the president is doing what he can to secure the release of Amir. Every time I've spoken to him about it, he's very familiar with the case. So we just have to not let these cases fade into the woodwork, and that's the main reason I invited Sara and her husband to Washington.
We had this situation where the sailors from the United States were captured by Iran just right before the State of the Union address and then released, and the Obama administration and Secretary of State John Kerry are saying, well, this is a sign that diplomatic relations are better. We can negotiate, those sort of things. So does that create any sort of an opening, do you think, that could ultimately lead to Amir Hekmati's release?
I think it's possible. I mean, the one thing it clearly indicates is that while we have big differences with Iran and that they continue to engage in bad behavior, until recently, we never would have been able to have direct discussion with them, even if it's about sailors or something else. It would have had to go through some other diplomatic channel, which complicates the process. I take that as a small step, but a positive step toward trying to bring Iran into the global community. It's going to take a long ways to get them to a place where they're a full partner in the international community. They have to stop engaging in all the bad behaviors. But, you know, these things change in small steps, and I view this as an important but positive small step.
Governor Snyder, just the other day, deployed the National Guard units to Flint to address the water crisis. You have been quite critical of the Snyder administration. You're certainly not alone on that for how it has responded to the lead found in drinking water in Flint. What else now? What's the next step for the state here? Have they met what you think they should be doing, or are there other steps that they should take now that the National Guard is involved?
Yeah, I think it was a very positive step to bring in the National Guard. I had been calling for that for some time. Others had as well. Why it took until the middle of January for the governor to deploy the National Guard is somewhat beyond my comprehension. It's a step in the right direction, but there is a lot more that needs to be done. I'm not even satisfied right now that the level of engagement by the state and even the volume of National Guard participation is going to be sufficient. I mean, people still can't get drinkable water. We've got to address that. But I think what is lost on this and some of the discussion is that this is in part a short-term emergency. The water's not drinkable in Flint. It won't be for a couple of months until the corrosion control is fully optimized. So there's this short-term need to get people help, to get them water. But there's a much bigger, longer-term question, and I've heard very little from the governor on his willingness to step up and do what's right by making sure that the children, particularly, that have been exposed to high levels of lead in their water, who will potentially experience life-changing developmental challenges as a result, those children need and could benefit from help. Early childhood education, for example. Nutritional support, ongoing educational support during the course of their developmental process. Those are the kinds of things that medicine and science has shown us can help a child overcome developmental challenges resulting from lead exposure. And I think the state, because the state did this, has a moral obligation not just to deal with the short-term crisis, but to provide some justice for those children and give them at least a chance at life by providing them all of that support. They need everything that we can muster for them. And the state, which made the decision to go to the river water source, failed to apply proper science in that decision, denied the fact that lead was in the water when they knew that it was. They have created this problem, and they have a moral and financial obligation to make it right.
The Detroit News had a story yesterday saying that the Environmental Protection Agency had knowledge as early as April about the lack of corrosion controls in Flint's water supply. Are there some questions that need to be asked of federal regulators as well?
Well, here's the problem. Yes. And here's what I would have preferred from the Environmental Protection Agency, that they not just push the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, but let the public know, let me know that they were aware of this potential problem. I think where this gets a little bit more complicated is that it's quite disingenuous for folks in state government to try to point the finger at the EPA, because the state has the legal primary responsibility for enforcement of the Clean Drinking Water Law. EPA oversees that, has some authority, but what we've seen in the last couple of decades is state governments pushing back and pushing back and pushing back and trying to get the EPA out of their business. And so the EPA's authority has been minimized over the years. And you know, this is part of sort of a national political narrative that's been going on, beating up the EPA, cutting their budget, trying to limit their ability to intrude into states and, in fact, assert states' rights as a reason to keep the EPA out of their business. And then when the state completely fails to try to point the finger at the policeman, the EPA, and blame the policeman for not stopping them from doing something that damaged people in the city of Flint, it's a bit disingenuous. I will say this. I will be pursuing changes in federal law that strengthen the EPA's ability to enforce and opens up greater transparency when the EPA becomes aware of a problem like this, so that we don't rely on the good intentions of state regulators, because in this case, we clearly could not rely on their veracity, that we could not rely on the state to be honest with the people of this the state of Michigan, because they clearly said things that they knew not to be true.
The Natural Resources Defense Council, though, put out a statement pretty critical of the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, they did say that the people of Flint have been failed by their leaders in government at the city, state, and federal level, but they also say it's beyond understanding that the EPA was paralyzed for 9 months while waiting for a legal opinion on their powers in the midst of a crisis. Do you think that's a fair statement by the NRDC?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I just think I'm trying to make sure that the focus right now is on what we need to do to help the kids in Flint. And to me, because the state made the decisions that led to this, I acknowledge that the EPA could and should be stronger in their oversight. I do find it interesting, though, that state governors generally push back on that. But I think the Natural Resources Defense Council makes a very good point that we need a stronger Environmental Protection Agency that's more aggressive and more transparent. And I will do everything I can to make sure, that based on this experience, that they have all the tools they need and basically are charged with making sure that when they are aware of a problem such as this, that they don't keep it to themselves. Now, what the EPA did was press the State Department of Environmental Quality to get to work on this. And I think where there is some reason to have some understanding of the EPA's position is that the EPA was also told by the Department of Environmental Quality that they had initiated corrosion control in Flint, when in fact they had not. So I don't think that lets the EPA off the hook, because they shouldn't take the state government at their word any more than they would take some private company that they were regulating at their word, they should have verified that. But when a state agency essentially lies to the EPA, the culpability falls much more on the state agency than on the Environmental Protection Agency.
We just found out yesterday of a spike in cases of Legionnaires' disease in Genesee County, and you issued a statement saying that there needs to be more involvement from the federal agencies after Governor Snyder put out his statement. Do you think that there are some lessons then from what happened with the lead in the drinking water in Flint that federal agencies should apply, assuming they do get involved in addressing this Legionnaires' outbreak?
Well, I think the biggest lesson is we cannot as a nation defer to the states to do the right thing and then not, when they fail, not accept the fact that we all have a responsibility to make sure that the public is protected. And again, this gets back to this sort of new federalism, this devolution of authority and rights to the states. It all sounds really good until something like this happens. It sounds good to a lot of people. It's never sounded that good to me. But you know, that's, I think principally this is an argument for a much stronger federal role, particularly when it comes to the protection of public health. We should have every level of government fully engaged in this. If there's a particular lesson that the state government ought to learn, and I think the governor should heed, is that he should listen to his critics. Listen to those people who are telling them things that they don't want to hear. Listen to Miguel del Toro, for example, who was the EPA official who would not let this go, who actually came to Flint to test water and blew the whistle. Listen to Mark Edwards, the Virginia Tech professor who's made a career of studying water systems, who said something is wrong in Flint and was basically ridiculed by the State Department of Environmental Quality. Listen to Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, the Flint pediatrician who did research that showed elevated blood levels in children. When that data came out, they tried to discredit this pediatrician who has devoted her life to the health of children and has an impeccable record. And so their natural reaction was to try to discredit those voices that were telling them the things they didn't want to hear, rather than listen to them and maybe consider the fact that they might have something to what they're saying and be a little more honest about the responsibility that they have.
Congressman Kildee, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dan Kildee is a Democrat. His district includes the city of Flint. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.